Our second reading is from Luke chapter 2, verses 13 through 36. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of us who were with him went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then Jesus said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scripture. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed, and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road and he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, 'The Lord has indeed risen and has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had made known to them, how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread. While they were talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, 'Peace be with you.' Holy wisdom, holy word. I love this story for so many reasons. I love that it's written so dramatically, with lively dialogue and dramatic pauses and emotions. We hear that the disciples were astonished, that they were sad. And I love that it's yet another story that features clueless disciples. Cleopas and his nameless friend find themselves in the aftermath of Jesus' death at the hands of the state. They have just been informed that his body is no longer in the tomb. It's another blow to what they've witnessed in the last 3 days. They're grieving and they're confused. They thought that Jesus was going to be the one who was going to save the spiritual Israel. But that's not how it went down. They just witnessed his humiliating death. This was not what they signed up for. So along the road to Emmaus, they're hashing it out with one another, trying to decode what happened and compare it to all the sermons that they'd heard, the miracles, the healing, the prophecy. And then Jesus sidles up to them, and they don't recognize him. And he says, "Hey, so what were you guys talking about just now?" And they stop. Are you kidding me? Have you not heard about the things that have happened in Jerusalem? And Jesus totally plays dumb. He says, what things? He uses a classic teaching and parenting move right there. Play dumb and see what explanation they come up with to see if they've been paying attention or not. So they give him their explanation, and he rebukes them with a typical philosophical retort. Oh, you foolish people. You can almost hear the eye roll right there. And then he says to them, how slow of heart you are to believe what the prophets declared. Slow of heart, he says. And this stands out to me because he doesn't say to them, oh, you're so slow of mind, or you're so stupid, or can't you put the facts together and figure this out, make logical sense out of this? No, he points to the sluggish hearts. And in this and in other parts of Scripture, it's clear that the heart, or the soul, and not the mind, is the center of intelligence and will. God turns the heart of parents to their children. And Jesus says things like, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And he points to instances left and right when people's hearts are hardened or opened. The heart is the seat of transformation. And this is the place where the truest experience of God can be had. When the projections and untruths that we've been telling ourselves, about other people, about God, when these things fall away. So it's not that Cleopas and his friend don't believe the right facts about Jesus and the scriptures, but they can't put it together because their hearts are not in it. Their minds are stuck. The contemplative tradition, which you've heard me talk about, teaches that the mind is where our ego resides. And in order to bypass the ego, we have to drop our minds out of our thoughts, worries, anxieties, and fear, and into the place of presence and feeling, the heart. In this story, the disciples' hearts are still captive to their ego. Our egos are the part of us that clamor for esteem, affection, security, power, and control. And the disciples' egos here are trying to rationalize, explain, and protect their own story about this. Their egos told them that Jesus was the Messiah and Jesus would be a powerful ruler, bringing them alongside him into power and prestige. He was the one to redeem the spiritual Israel. Their egos didn't let the real message of Jesus sink in. Remember, the disciples are always the ones who are jockeying for position. They're always wanting to know who Jesus loved the most, wanting the best seat at the table. Jesus could spend all day healing lepers and preaching about how the last shall be first, and those who seek to save their life will lose it. And these morons will come back and say something like, hey, Jesus, who's your favorite disciple? It's me, right? Can I sit on your right side? Their hearts were not ready for the message that Jesus had while he was alive with them. And they were definitely not ready for the way that he allowed himself to be arrested and treated like a common criminal. So in this story, we see the disciples starting to put together a puzzle, as if scales were slowly falling from their eyes. And I love that after they taste the bread with him, they recognize who he is. And they start to put all the pieces together. Their aha moment comes kind of slowly here. I can picture Cleopas sitting at the table, chewing the bread, stopping mid-bite, jaw dropping, and saying to the other disciples, wait, were our hearts not burning within us while he was walking with us on the road, opening the scriptures to us? He looks back on the walk with Jesus and he realizes that his heart was way ahead of his mind in comprehending what was going on. Were our hearts not burning? The Greek verb translated burning here is kaiomene, which is sometimes associated in other Greek texts with emotions such as love. So in other words, when the disciples were walking with Jesus, love was building in their hearts. They were burning with love. Their hearts resonated with the person that they were encountering. And then their eyes were open and they were able to see him finally in the breaking of the bread. What they saw before them in this person who was sharing bread was the one who had done this so many times before. Sitting at a table with some confused, scared people sharing comfort food. And my guess is they still didn't have a clue what the heck Jesus was talking about in that moment. They couldn't wrap their minds around it, as we might say. But their hearts did get it. There was a breakthrough. And I dare say in that moment, it didn't really matter if their minds got it or not. In that moment, they didn't have to construct a theology of atonement or be able to proof text the argument for Jesus being the Messiah or even believe that he had risen from the dead. Their hearts knew the truth that they needed in that encounter. So what's there for us to take away from that encounter, from the intelligence that was seated in those disciples' hearts? Many of us, like the disciples, are quick, generally, pretty quick to trust our minds, above all, to make decisions, to interpret the world around us. We can tend to react and to analyze and to judge rather than to lead from a place of love and non-judgment. The mind is where we jump to conclusions, where we stereotype, where we're afraid. So how do we begin to peek below the surface of ordinary awareness into the realm of the heart? How do we get closer to a spiritual awareness that allows us to pay attention to how our hearts are burning within us? How do we engage our hearts, our intuition, our bodies, our collective wisdom, and deepen our grounding in our lives as whole people by tapping into the wisdom and experience of our hearts? Well, first of all, we have to pay attention to what's happening interiorly in our hearts and even in our bodies. And so I'm going to give you a moment of silence right now to just notice what's happening in your heart right now. What are you sensing, feeling in this moment? Without judgment or expectation, just notice it. If we desire to engage our hearts and our souls in everyday life, we need to bring our whole selves to this broken and beautiful world. I know that my way of being in the world, my response to injustice, my work, my way of loving others has to come from a grounded whole place. And for me, this means engaging regularly and daily, if possible, in contemplative practices. One of my practices to this end is centering prayer. This has become a lifeline for me. It's a wordless form of prayer where the intention is just to be open in an emotional posture of surrender to God's love and action within. For 20 minutes, or if you're short on time, you can do 14 minutes or 5 minutes. I have to do 21. I set my alarm for 21 minutes because it gives me a minute to settle down. For 20 minutes or so, you sit in silence and you meet any thoughts with a sacred word such as love. And then you let the thought go and return to openness. Nothing happens. You're not listening for God to speak or waiting for instruction or trying to clear your mind. You're just letting yourself be open to love. It's a way to let your head sink down into your heart, to set aside your tendencies to analyze, control, explain, and problem solve. When we're in our heads, I don't know about you, but we're always telling ourselves stories, explaining, complaining, wanting things to be different. Our ego's working really hard. And in order to bypass that, even just for a moment, and to be present to what is, we need to gently dismantle those stories and explanations and engage our hearts. We saw from the gospel story the way that an engaged heart can lead to true encounter, to connection, to truth. I started practicing centering prayer after my father died about 7 years ago. In that year, my faith disappeared. It evaporated. In the midst of my grief, we were going through the grief of losing my dad. We were in the process of adopting my son. There was a lot going on. I lost my grounding. I became untethered. I stopped believing anything about Christianity. I decided it was all made up, that it made no sense at all. And so a few months into this, I was out in Oregon, and I shared my faith crisis with one of my friends and former colleague, John. He's a professor. He's a theologian. He loves every living creature, and he has a long-term contemplative prayer practice. He sits in silence twice a day, every day. And I told him I don't believe any of this Christian stuff anymore. And he said to me, "Yeah, but I know you. You are a mystic and you believe this stuff in your heart. You're too much in your head right now. You need to get out of your head." And he basically ordered me to start practicing centering prayer every day. And I love this guy and I trust him, so I did it, even though I thought it was completely useless. I figured no one's on the other side of my prayer, so why am I doing this? But I kept at it because John said I should do it. I tried to remain open, meeting my thoughts with a sacred word, love. And for me, about a year and a half into practicing this, as often as I could, something shifted. The prayer slowly quieted my need for answers to my questions. My heart overcame my head, which is what I needed. And love, the word that my heart was saying over and over again, broke through my despair. Deep down within me, there was a desire to connect again with that God that I knew I had experienced throughout my life. The mystic Simone Weil says, "The intelligence can only be led by desire. Desire directed toward God is the only power capable of raising the soul. Or rather, it is God alone who comes down and possesses the soul, but desire alone draws God." I finally came to know that God was calling me back to God's self through this prayer. My questions about the historicity of Jesus or the validity of the Bible and all that, they were not answered, but they no longer had the weight that they had before. And I want to be careful to point out right now that this move to pay attention to our hearts is not one which ignores our intelligence. And it does not mean to become chained to following our emotion, our intuition. It's more a call to wholeness and not to ignoring all the intelligences that we can use to experience God. For me, this has been a journey away from a division within myself that I didn't know existed previously. It shined a light on my need for control and security and certainty in a very uncertain time. And at the same time, it showed me a way not to be ruled by those needs. There was no relief from suffering. Nothing changed. My grief was certainly not ended. There was no moment of blinding light or outward gesture, just an inward yes. My heart was drawn to a place that my mind couldn't access. A truth deeper than logical explanation, a groan too deep for words. Was my heart not burning within me? This practice of centering prayer is one of the ways that I'm walking this journey towards wholeness. It's been a lifeline for me in this past year, especially when life here in the U.S. feels less safe. While racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, transphobia are out and unashamed, and raising their ugly and violent heads. For others of you in times of trouble, your ways of being grounded might be different. They might be meditation, exercise, walking, yoga, connecting with other people, journaling, art, creating spreadsheets. So friends, what has been your lifeline when things have gotten difficult? What is keeping you engaged, drawing you towards wholeness? I'm going to give you a moment to call those things to mind right now. What draws you to wholeness? Our own wholeness is the first step. And then we can bring that wholeness to life as a community, as God's beloved community. We can keep our ears tuned for that still, small voice that is heard when the other voices that vie for attention are stilled. So how can we make space for the silence to speak? For our assumptions about others to recede in the background so that we can truly hear. When we bring our whole selves to the game, our egos can take a back seat. We're no longer being driven as strongly by our desire for control and security, or even our desire for status and affection. Our full engagement is important not just so that we are healthy, or even so that TAB survives and thrives as a congregation, but for the sake of the world. The deepening of racial and religious divisions, othering, and violence in our country demand a response from us as disciples of Jesus. We are people who have said we choose a path that's contrary to this violent, self-serving world. And if we're to be ready to stand in that gap, we will have to bring our souls with us. We will have to let our hearts lead us beyond divisions and into wholeness. We will have to be fully engaged, hearts, minds, souls, bodies. The disciples felt their hearts burning within them, and their eyes were opened. Their egos were pierced by radical love. And they went on to take the risks that they were too scared to take while Jesus was still walking among them. They stepped out of their petty arguments over who was the greatest, and they went on to build a movement patterned after the one who broke bread with them, who rode into Jerusalem on a donkey instead of a white horse, who invited the outcasts to the party, and who told us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. And we also have the chance to bring our engaged selves to this broken world, to bring healing. May we find ways to bring our whole selves into conversations, to encounters with people who we know and who we don't know. May we invite a new depth to our presence with others, allow ourselves to drop below the surface of ordinary awareness to a place that is open to divine love. May our transformed hearts lead the way as we grow together as a church, as we engage with the world, and as we witness and are witnesses to peace and justice in this world. May we pay attention to the burning in our hearts and be transformed by the divine love that sets our hearts aflame.